There were at this time about 13 Tamilians in our party. 5 Tamil youngsters had accompanied me from South Africa, and the rest came from different parts of the country. We were in all about 25 men and women. This is how the ashram was started. All had their meals in a common kitchen and strove to live as one family. The ashram had been in existence only a few months when we were put to a test, such as I'd scarcely expected. I received a letter to this effect. A humble and honest, untouchable family is desirous of joining your ashram. Will you accept them? I was perturbed. I had never expected that an untouchable family, with an introduction from no less a man than Thakkar Bappa, would so soon be seeking admission to the ashram. I shared the letter with my companions. They welcomed it. I wrote, expressing our willingness to accept the family, provided all the members were ready to abide by the rules of the ashram. But their admission created a flutter amongst the friends who had been helping the ashram. The very first difficulty was found with regard to the use of the well, which was partly controlled by the owner of the bungalow. The man in charge of the water lift objected that drops of water from our bucket would pollute him. So he took to swearing at us. I told everyone to put up with the abuse and continue drawing water at any cost. When he saw that we did not return his abuse, the man became ashamed and ceased to bother us. All monetary help, however, was stopped. The friend who had asked that question about an untouchable being able to follow the rules of the ashram had never expected that any such would be forthcoming. With the stopping of monetary help came rumors of proposed social boycott. We were prepared for all this. I had told my companions that if we were boycotted and denied the usual facilities, we would not leave. We would rather go and stay in the untouchable's quarter and live on whatever we could get by manual labor. Matters came to such a pass that Maganlal Gandhi one day gave me this notice. We are out of funds and there is nothing for the next month. I quietly replied, "Then we shall go to the untouchable's quarter." This was not the first time I'd been faced with such a trial. On all such occasions, God has sent help at the last moment. One morning, shortly after Maganlal had given me warning of our monetary plight, one of the children came and said that a Sheth who was waiting in a car outside wanted to see me. I went out to him. "I want to give the ashram some help. Will you accept it?" he asked. "Most certainly," said I, "and I confess I am at the present moment at the end of my resources." "I shall come tomorrow at this time," he said. "Will you be here?" "Yes," said I, and he left. Next day, exactly at the appointed hour, the car drew up near our quarters and the horn was blown. The children came with the news. The Sheth did not come in. I went out to see him. He placed in my hands currency notes and drove away. I had never expected this help, and what a novel way of rendering it. The gentleman had never before visited the ashram. So far as I can remember, I had met him only once. No visits, no inquiries, simply rendering help and going away. This was a unique experience for me. The help deferred the exodus to the untouchable's quarter. We now felt quite safe for a year. Just as there was a storm outside, so was there a storm in the ashram itself. Though in South Africa, untouchable friends used to come to my place and live and feed with me, my wife and other women did not seem quite to relish the admission into the ashram of the untouchable friend. My eyes and ears easily detected their indifference, if not their dislike. The monetary difficulty had caused me no anxiety, but this internal storm was more than I could bear. The admission of this family proved a valuable lesson to the ashram. In the very beginning, we proclaimed to the world that the ashram would not countenance untouchability. Those who wanted to help the ashram were thus put on their guard, and the work of the ashram in this direction was considerably simplified. The fact that it is mostly the real Orthodox Hindus who have met the daily growing expenses of the ashram is perhaps a clear indication that untouchability is shaken to its foundation. There are indeed many other proofs of this, But the fact that good Hindus do not scruple to help an ashram where we go the length of dining with the untouchable is no small proof. I am sorry that I should have to skip over quite a number of things pertaining to this subject. How we tackled delicate questions arising out of the main question. How we had to overcome some unexpected difficulties. And various other matters which are quite relevant to a description of experiments with truth. The pages that follow will also suffer from the same drawback. I shall have to omit important details, because most of the characters in the drama are still alive, and it is not proper, without permission, to use their names in connection with events with which they are concerned. It is hardly practicable to obtain their consent, or to get them every now and then to revise the sections concerning themselves. Besides, such procedure is outside the limit of this autobiography. I therefore fear that the rest of the story, valuable as it is in my opinion to seekers after truth, will be told with inevitable omissions. Nevertheless, it is my desire and hope, God willing, to bring this narrative down to the days of non-cooperation. We shall take leave of the ashram, which in the very beginning had to weather internal and external storms, and briefly advert to a matter that engaged my attention. Indentured laborers were those who had emigrated from India to labor under an indenture for 5 years or less. Under the Smuts-Gandhi settlement of 1914, the £3 tax in respect of the indentured immigrants to Natal had been abolished, but the general emigration from India still needed treatment. In March 1916, there moved a resolution in the Imperial Legislative Council for the abolition of the indenture system. In accepting the motion, the Viceroy announced that he had obtained from His Majesty's government the promise of the abolition in due course of the system. I felt, however, that India could not be satisfied with so very vague an assurance, but ought to agitate for immediate abolition. India had tolerated the system through her sheer negligence, and I believed the time had come when people could successfully agitate for this redress. I met some of the leaders, wrote in the press, and saw that public opinion was solidly in favor of immediate abolition. Might this be a fit subject for Satyagraha? I had no doubt that it was, but I did not know the modus operandi. In the meantime, the Viceroy had made no secret of the meaning of the eventual abolition, which, as he said, was abolition within such a reasonable time as will allow of alternative arrangements being introduced. So, in February 1917, there was introduced a bill for the immediate abolition of the system. Lord Chelmsford refused permission. It was time for me to tour the country for an all-India agitation. I visited Karachi, Calcutta, and various other places. There were fine meetings everywhere, and there was unbounded enthusiasm. I had not expected anything like it when the agitation was launched. In those days, I used to travel alone and had therefore wonderful experiences. The authorities were always after me, but as I had nothing to conceal, they did not molest me, nor did I cause them any trouble. Fortunately, I had not then received the stamp of Mahatmaship, though the shout of that name was quite common where people knew me. On one occasion, the detectives disturbed me at several stations, asked for my ticket, and took down the number. I, of course, readily replied to all the questions they asked. My fellow passengers had taken me to be a sadhu, or a faker. When they saw that I was being molested at every station, they were exasperated and swore at the detectives. "Why are you worrying the poor sadhu for nothing?" they protested. "Don't you show these scoundrels your ticket?" they said, addressing me. I said to them gently, "It is no trouble to show them my ticket. They are doing their duty." The passengers were not satisfied. They evinced more and more sympathy and strongly objected to this sort of ill-treatment of innocent men. But the detectives were nothing. The real hardship was the third-class traveling. My bitterest experience was from Lahore to Delhi. I was going to Calcutta from Karachi via Lahore, where I had to change trains. It was impossible to find a place in the train. It was full, and those who could get in did so by sheer force, often sneaking through windows if the doors were locked. I had to reach Calcutta on the date fixed for the meeting, and if I missed this train, I could not arrive in time. I'd almost given up hope of getting in. No one was willing to accept me. When a porter, discovering my plight, came to me and said, "Give me 12 annas and I'll get you a seat." "Yes," said I, "you shall have 12 annas if you do procure me a seat." The young man went from carriage to carriage entreating passengers, but no one heeded him. As the train was about to start, some passengers said, "There is no room here, but you can shove him in if you like. He will have to stand." "Well," asked the young porter. I readily agreed, and he shoved me in bodily through the window. Thus I got in, and the porter earned his 12 annas. The night was a trial. The other passengers were sitting somehow. I stood 2 hours holding the chain of the upper bunk. Meanwhile, some of the passengers kept worrying me incessantly. "Why will you not sit down?" they asked. I tried to reason with them, saying there was no room, but they could not tolerate my standing, though they were lying full length on the upper bunks. They did not tire of worrying me, neither did I tire of gently replying to them. This at last mollified them. Some of them asked me my name, and when I gave it, they felt ashamed. They apologized and made room for me. Patience was thus rewarded. I was dead tired, and my head was reeling. God sent help just when it was most needed. In that way, I somehow reached Delhi and thence Calcutta. The Maharaja of Kasim Bazar, the president of the Calcutta meeting, was my host. Just as in Karachi, here also there was unbounded enthusiasm. The meeting was attended by several Englishmen. Before the 31st of July, the government announced that indentured emigration from India was stopped. Champaran is the land of King Janaka. Just as it abounds in mango groves, so used it to be full of indigo plantations until the year 1917. The Champaran tenant was bound by law to plant 3 out of every 20 parts of his land with indigo for his landlord. I must confess that I did not then know even the name, much less the geographical position, of Champaran, and I had hardly any notion of indigo plantations. I had seen packets of indigo, but little dreamed that it was grown and manufactured in Champaran at great hardship to thousands of agriculturists. My object was to inquire into the condition of the Champaran agriculturists and understand their grievances against the indigo planters. But I deemed it essential, before starting on my inquiry, to know the planter's side of the case and see the commissioner of the division. I sought and was granted appointments with both. The secretary of the Planters Association told me plainly that I was an outsider and that I had no business to come between the planters and their tenants. But if I had any representation to make, I might submit it in writing. I politely told him that I did not regard myself as an outsider and that I had every right to inquire into the condition of the tenants if they desired me to do so. The commissioner, on whom I called, proceeded to bully me and advised me forthwith to leave Tirhut. I acquainted my co-workers with all this and told them that there was a likelihood of government stopping me from proceeding further and that I might have to go to jail earlier than I'd expected, and that if I was to be arrested, it would be best that the arrest should take place in Motihari or, if possible, in Petihar. It was advisable, therefore, that I should go to those places as early as possible. So, I started with my co-workers for Motihari the same day. The very same day, we heard that about 5 miles from Motihari, a tenant had been ill-treated. It was decided that I should go and see him the next morning, and we accordingly set off for the place on elephant's back. An elephant, by the way, is about as common in Champaran as a bullock cart in Gujarat. We had scarcely gone halfway when a messenger from the police superintendent overtook us and said that the latter had sent his compliments. I saw what he meant. Having left Daharanid Har Babu to proceed to the original destination, I got into the hired carriage which the messenger had brought. He then served on me a notice to leave Champaran and drove me to my place. On his asking me to acknowledge the service of the notice, I wrote to the effect that I did not propose to comply with it and leave Champaran till my inquiry was finished. Thereupon I received a summons to take my trial the next day for disobeying the order to leave Champaran. The news of the notice and the summons spread like wildfire, and I was told that Motihari that day witnessed unprecedented scenes. The courthouse overflowed with men. Fortunately, I had finished all my work during the night, and so was able to cope with the crowds. My companions proved the greatest help. They occupied themselves with regulating the crowds, for the latter followed me wherever I went. A sort of friendliness sprang up between the official, collector, magistrate, police superintendent, and myself. I might have legally resisted the notices served on me. Instead, I accepted them all, and my conduct towards the officials was correct. They thus saw that I did not want to offend them personally, but that I wanted to offer civil resistance to their orders. In this way, they were put at ease, and instead of harassing me, they gladly availed themselves of my and my co-workers' cooperation in regulating the crowds. But it was an ocular demonstration to them of the fact that their authority was shaken. The people had, for the moment, lost all fear of punishment and yielded obedience to the power of love which their new friend exercised. It should be remembered that no one knew me in Champaran. The peasants were all ignorant, Champaran being far up north of the Ganges and right at the foot of the Himalayas in close proximity to Nepal, was cut off from the rest of India. The Congress was practically unknown in those parts. Even those who had heard the name of the Congress shrank from joining it or even mentioning it. And now the Congress and its members had entered this land, though not in the name of the Congress, yet in a far more real sense. In consultation with my co-workers, I had decided that nothing should be done in the name of the Congress. What we wanted was work and not name, substance and not shadow. For the name of the Congress was the bête noire of the government and their controllers, the planters. To them, the Congress was a byword for lawyers' wrangles, evasion of law through legal loopholes, a byword for bomb and anarchical crime and for diplomacy and hypocrisy. We had to disillusion them both. Therefore, we had decided not to mention the name of the Congress and not to acquaint the peasants with the organization called the Congress. It was enough, we thought, if they understood and followed the spirit of the Congress instead of its letter. No emissaries had therefore been sent there, openly or secretly, on behalf of the Congress to prepare the ground for our arrival. No political work had yet been done amongst them. The world outside Champaran was not known to them. And yet they received me as though we had been age-long friends. It is no exaggeration, but the literal truth to say that in this meeting with the peasants I was face to face with God, Ahimsa, and truth. When I come to examine my title to this realization, I find nothing but my love for the people. And this, in turn, is nothing but an expression of my unshakable faith in Ahimsa. That day in Champaran was an unforgettable event in my life, and a red-letter day for the peasants and for me. According to the law, I was to be on my trial, but truly speaking, government was to be on its trial. The commissioner only succeeded in trapping government in the net which he had spread for me. The trial began. The government pleader, the magistrate and other officials were on tenterhooks. They were at a loss to know what to do. The government pleader was pressing the magistrate to postpone the case. But I interfered and requested the magistrate not to postpone the case, as I wanted to plead guilty to having disobeyed the order to leave Champaran. Before I could appear before the court to receive the sentence, the magistrate sent a written message that the lieutenant governor had ordered the case against me to be withdrawn, and the collector wrote to me saying that I was at liberty to conduct the proposed inquiry, and that I might count on whatever help I needed from the officials. None of us was prepared for this prompt and happy issue. The country thus had its first direct object lesson in civil disobedience. The affair was freely discussed, both locally and in the press, and my inquiry got unexpected publicity. It was necessary for my inquiry that the government should remain neutral, but the inquiry did not need support from press reporters or leading articles in the press. Indeed, the situation in Champaran was so delicate and difficult that over-energetic criticism or highly colored reports might easily damage the cause which I was seeking to espouse. So, I wrote to the editors of the principal papers, requesting them not to trouble to send any reporters, as I should send them whatever might be necessary for publication and keep them informed. I knew that the government attitude countenancing my presence had displeased the Champaran planters, and I knew that even the officials, though they could say nothing openly, could hardly have liked it. Incorrect or misleading reports, therefore, were likely to incense them all the more, and their ire, instead of descending on me, would be sure to descend on the poor and seriously hinder my search for the truth about the case. In spite of these precautions, the planters engineered against me a poisonous agitation. All sorts of falsehoods appeared in the press about my co-workers and myself. But my extreme cautiousness and my insistence on truth, even to the minutest detail, turned the edge of their sword. In such a delicate situation as this, I did not think it proper to invite any leaders from other provinces. Pandit Malaviyaji had sent me an assurance that whenever I wanted him, I had only to send him word. But I did not trouble him. I thus prevented the struggle from assuming a political aspect. But I sent to the leaders and the principal papers occasional reports, not for publication, but merely for their information. I had seen that even where the end might be political, but where the cause was non-political, one damaged it by giving it a political aspect and helped it by keeping it within its non-political limit. The Champaran struggle was a proof of the fact that disinterested service of the people in any sphere ultimately helps the country politically. No breathing time was, however, in store for me. A condition approaching famine had arisen in the Khedda district owing to a widespread failure of crops, and the Patidars of Khedda were considering the question of getting the revenue assessment for the year suspended. The cultivators' demand was as clear as daylight, and so moderate as to make out a strong case for its acceptance. Under the land revenue rules, if the crop was 4 annas or under, the cultivators could claim full suspension of the revenue assessment for the year. According to the official figures, the crop was said to be over 4 annas. The contention of the cultivators, on the other hand, was that it was less than 4 annas. But the government was in no mood to listen and regarded the popular demand for arbitration as lèse majesté. At last, all petitioning and prayer having failed, after taking counsel with co-workers, I advised the Patidars to resort to Satyagraha. For the Patidar farmers, the fight was quite a new thing. We had therefore to go about from village to village explaining the principles of Satyagraha. The main thing was to rid the agriculturists of their fear by making them realize that the officials were not the masters, but the servants of the people, inasmuch as they received their salaries from the taxpayer. And then it seemed well nigh impossible to make them realize the duty of combining civility with fearlessness. Once they had shed the fear of the officials, how could they be stopped from returning their insults? And yet if they resorted to incivility, it would spoil their satyagraha like a drop of arsenic in milk. I realized later that they had less fully learnt the lesson of civility than I had expected. Experience had taught me that civility is the most difficult part of satyagraha. Civility does not here mean the mere outward gentleness of speech cultivated for the occasion, but an inborn gentleness and desire to do the opponent good. These should show themselves in every act of a satyagrahi. In the initial stages, though the people exhibited much courage, the government did not seem inclined to take strong action. But as the people's firmness showed no signs of wavering, the government began coercion. The attachment officers sold the people's cattle and seized whatever movables they could lay hands on. Penalty notices were served, and in some cases standing crops were attached. This unnerved the peasants, some of whom paid up their dues, while others desired to place safe movables in the way of the officials, so that they might attach them to realize the dues. On the other hand, some were prepared to fight to the bitter end. The campaign came to an unexpected end. It was clear that the people were exhausted, and I hesitated to let the unbending be driven to utter ruin. I was casting about for some graceful way of terminating the struggle, which would be acceptable to a Satyagrahi. Such a one appeared quite unexpectedly. I was sent word that if well-to-do patidars paid up, the poorer ones would be granted suspension. I asked for a written undertaking to that effect, which was given. I inquired of the collector, who alone could give an undertaking in respect of the whole district, whether the undertaking was true for the whole district. He replied that orders declaring suspension in terms of the letter had already been issued. I was not aware of it, but if it was a fact, the people's pledge had been fulfilled. The pledge, it will be remembered, had the same things for its object, and so we expressed ourselves satisfied with the orders. However, the end was far from making me feel happy, inasmuch as it lacked the grace with which the termination of every Satyagraha campaign ought to be accompanied. The collector carried on as though he had done nothing by way of a settlement. The poor were to be granted suspension, but hardly any got the benefit of it. It was the people's right to determine who was poor, but they could not exercise it. I was sad that they had not the strength to exercise the right. Although, therefore, the termination was celebrated as a triumph of Satyagraha, I could not enthuse over it, as it lacked the essentials of a complete triumph. The end of a Satyagraha campaign can be described as worthy only when it leaves the Satyagrahi stronger and more spirited than they are in the beginning. The campaign was not, however, without its indirect results, which we can see today, and the benefit of which we are reaping. The Kheda Satyagraha marks the beginning of an awakening among the peasants, the beginning of their true political education. Public life in Gujarat became instinct with a new energy and a new vigor. The Patidar peasant came to an unforgettable consciousness of his strength. The lesson was indelibly imprinted on the public mind that the salvation of the people depends upon themselves, upon their capacity for suffering and sacrifice. Through the Kheda campaign, Satyagraha took firm root in the soil of Gujarat. Although, therefore, I found nothing to enthuse over in the termination of the Satyagraha, the Kheda peasants were jubilant because they knew that what they had achieved was commensurate with their effort, and they had found the true and infallible method for a redress of their grievances. This knowledge was enough justification for their jubilation. Nevertheless, the Kheda peasants had not fully understood the inner meaning of Satyagraha, and they saw it to their cost. Before one can be fit for the practice of civil disobedience, one must have rendered a willing and respectful obedience to the state laws. For the most part, we obey such laws out of the fear of the penalty for their breach, and this holds good particularly in respect of such laws as do not involve a moral principle. For instance, an honest, respectable man will not suddenly take to stealing, whether there is a law against stealing or not. But this very man will not feel any remorse for failure to observe the rule about carrying headlights on bicycles after dark. Indeed, it is doubtful whether he would even accept advice kindly about being more careful in this respect. But he would observe any obligatory rule of this kind, if only to escape the inconvenience of facing a prosecution for a breach of the rule. Such compliance is not, however, the willing and spontaneous obedience that is required of a Satyagrahi. A Satyagrahi obeys the laws of society intelligently and of his own free will because he considers it to be his sacred duty to do so. It is only when a person has thus obeyed the laws of society scrupulously that he is in a position to judge as to which particular rules are good and just, and which unjust and iniquitous. Only then does the right accrue to him of the civil disobedience of certain laws in well-defined circumstances. My error lay in my failure to observe this necessary limitation. I had called on the people to launch upon civil disobedience before they had thus qualified themselves for it, and this mistake seemed to me of Himalayan magnitude. As soon as I entered the Kedah district, all the old recollections of the Kedah Satyagraha struggle came back to me, and I wondered how I could have failed to perceive what was so obvious. I realized that before a people could be fit for offering civil disobedience, they should thoroughly understand its deeper implications. That being so, before restarting civil disobedience on a mass scale, it would be necessary to create a band of well-tried, pure-hearted volunteers who thoroughly understood the strict conditions of Satyagraha. They could explain these to the people, and by sleepless vigilance keep them on the right path. With these thoughts filling my mind, I raised a corps of Satyagrahi volunteers through the Satyagraha Sabha, and with their help commenced the work of educating the people with regard to the meaning and inner significance of Satyagraha. This was principally done by issuing leaflets of an educative character bearing on the subject. But whilst this work was going on, I could see that it was a difficult task to interest the people in the peaceful side of Satyagraha. The volunteers, too, failed to enlist themselves in large numbers, nor did all those who actually enlisted take anything like a regular systematic training. And as the days passed by, the number of fresh recruits began gradually to dwindle instead of to grow. I realized that the progress of the training in civil disobedience was not going to be as rapid as I had at first expected. The time has now come to bring this book to a close. It is not without a wrench that I have to take leave of the reader. I set a high value on my experiments. I do not know whether I've been able to do justice to them. I can only say that I have spared no pains to give a faithful narrative. To describe truth as it has appeared to me, and in the exact manner in which I have arrived at it, has been my ceaseless effort. The exercise has given me ineffable mental peace because it has been my fond hope that it might bring faith in truth and ahimsa to waverers. My uniform experience has convinced me that there is no other God than truth. And if every page of these chapters does not proclaim to the reader that the only means for the realization of truth is ahimsa, I shall deem all my labor in writing these chapters to have been in vain. And even though my efforts in this behalf may prove fruitless, let the readers know that the vehicle, not the great principle, is at fault. After all, however sincere my strivings after ahimsa may have been, they have still been imperfect and inadequate. The little fleeting glimpses, therefore, that I have been able to have of truth can hardly convey an idea of the indescribable luster of truth, a million times more intense than that of the sun we daily see with our eyes. In fact, what I have caught is only the faintest glimmer of that mighty effulgence. But this much I can say with assurance, as a result of all my experiments, that a perfect vision of truth can only follow a complete realization of ahimsa. To see the universal and all-pervading spirit of truth face to face, one must be able to love the meanest of creation as oneself. And a man who aspires after that cannot afford to keep out of any field of life. That is why my devotion to truth has drawn me into the field of politics. And I can say without the slightest hesitation, and yet in all humility, that those who say that religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion means. Identification with everything that lives is impossible without self-purification. Without self-purification, the observance of the law of Ahimsa must remain an empty dream. God can never be realized by one who is not pure of heart. Self-purification, therefore, must mean purification in all the walks of life. And purification being highly infectious, purification of oneself necessarily leads to the purification of one's surroundings. But the path of self-purification is hard and steep. To attain to perfect purity, one has to become absolutely passion-free in thought, speech, and action. To rise above the opposing currents of love and hatred, attachment and repulsion. I know that I have not in me as yet that triple purity, in spite of constant, ceaseless striving for it. That is why the world's praise fails to move me. Indeed, it very often stings me. To conquer the subtle passions seems to me to be harder far than the physical conquest of the world by the force of arms. Ever since my return to India, I have had experiences of the dormant passions lying hidden within me. The knowledge of them has made me feel humiliated, though not defeated. The experiences and experiments have sustained me and given me great joy, but I know that I have still before me a difficult path to traverse. I must reduce myself to zero. So long as a man does not of his own free will put himself last among his fellow creatures, there is no salvation for him. Ahimsa is the farthest limit of humility. In bidding farewell to the reader, for the time being at any rate, I ask him to join with me in prayer to the God of Truth that he may grant me the boon of Ahimsa in mind, word, and deed. This is Frederick Davidson for Audio Scholar. Thank you for listening.